and then let them trick it out. Insta would have a millennial flavor. X would be directed at political junkies. And Facebook would target the boomers. Outside of the campaign, we already had the K-Hive, an online presence that had sprung up organically in 2017 and swarmed back in force to support me throughout the campaign. These digitally savvy fans, most of whom I did not know, had an encyclopedic knowledge of my record and would vigorously rebut anything inaccurate that was posted about me. We put polls in the field that day. There was an urgent need to find out what voters knew about me and what their impressions were so that we could shape our messaging. I knew I needed to leave these details in the hands of others. We would fail if I tried to micromanage them. I just have to go with God and trust the team. There's no such thing as a low-key event in a presidential campaign. I had to be 100% present for the thousands of voters I'd be meeting every day. I couldn't be constantly evaluating and questioning everyone else. It wouldn't be good for their confidence or my peace of mind. Nonetheless, the buck stopped with me, and I was aware of that from the get-go. At 5 p.m., it was time to move to the stage. Over a floor speaker came Joe Biden's raspy voice. I could sense enormous effort. He was trying to sound upbeat, but you could hear the hurt as he hesitated over his words. If I didn't have COVID, I'd be sitting there with you, standing there with you. I'm so proud of what you've all done. But this COVID has been keeping me out of people's hair for the next 3 or 4 days. But I'm going to be on the road, and I'm not going anywhere. It's kept me away a bit, but, you know, I want people to remember that what we have done has been incredible. And we get so much more we're going to get done. And so I want to say hello to Kamala if she can hear me. I know she's going to be speaking shortly. And I want to say to the team, embrace her. She's the best. I wanted to call today to thank everybody in this effort. I know yesterday's news is surprising and it's hard for you to hear, but it was the right thing to do. He gained speed as he went on, praising the sacrifices of the campaign workers and promising to continue to bring the fight to Trump in his final months in the White House. The applause, when he finished, was warm and heartfelt. I hoped it lifted his spirits. All the questioning about his capacity had wounded him badly. He didn't want to get out of this race. He didn't want to stop being president. I was determined that he at least have his dignity. My feelings for him were grounded in warmth and loyalty, but they had become complicated over time with hurt and disappointment. At that moment, the warmth predominated. So when I took the stage, I spent the first third of my remarks effusively praising him before I launched into my own campaign speech. I would do that for several weeks until my campaign strategist urged me to stop. It's time this campaign was about you. It was David Plouffe who would eventually put it to me more bluntly. People hate Joe Biden. It was hard for me to hear that. The rapport between Joe and me was genuine. For two people who seemingly couldn't have been more different, our values were incredibly aligned. We cared about working people. We'd given our lives to public service. We would outdo each other, quoting sayings from our parents, and we both like to secretly and affectionately make fun of the British, drawing on our respective colonial ancestry, his Irish, mine Jamaican and Indian. Before the campaign got into gear, we met regularly for lunch in the private dining room just off the Oval Office. He'd have a club sandwich, I'd have grilled fish. And then, with a conspiratorial grin, he'd order us up a chocolate shake or a sundae. We discussed everything, from my bilateral meetings with leaders like Francis Emmanuel Macron, Philippines' Bongbong Marcos, and Ghana's Nana Akufo-Addo, to the latest political gossip from the Hill. But Plouffe was a realist. He knew that the president's approval rating of 41% was a ball and chain dragging on my campaign. It would take time, too much time, before I acknowledged this truth. But what I knew for certain, I faced an opponent who majored in malice, and I was damned if I was going to join the chorus of cruelty. Our administration had achieved great things, getting COVID under control, creating 15 million new jobs, standing up for democracy at home and abroad, passing bipartisan legislation that nobody thought would be possible in such a bitterly divided Congress, including a bipartisan infrastructure bill and the most significant climate-saving measures ever. In this first speech, in many that followed, and when elected president, I was determined to recognize Joe Biden for that. Then I turned to the job at hand, defining my own campaign and reminding people what I brought to the table. Before I was elected as vice president, before I was elected as United States Senator, I was the elected Attorney General of California. And before that, I was a courtroom prosecutor. In those roles, I took on perpetrators of all kinds. This politically savvy crowd was several jumps ahead. They knew where I was going and loved it. They signaled their approval with laughter and applause. Predators who abused women, fraudsters who ripped off consumers, cheaters who broke the rules for their own gain. So hear me when I say, I know Donald Trump's type. The crowd exploded. There are phrases in English that can do a lot of work for you. I know his type is one of them. We've all said it about someone of low character whom we've personally known. It chimes with memories of bad boyfriends, obnoxious bosses, shady businessmen, the kind of person you warn your kid not to befriend. I went on. As a young prosecutor, when I was in the Alameda County District Attorney's Office in California, I specialized in cases involving sexual abuse. Donald Trump was found liable by a jury for committing sexual abuse. As Attorney General of California, I took on one of our country's largest for-profit colleges and put it out of business. Donald Trump ran a for-profit college, Trump University, that was forced to pay $25 million to the students it scammed. As district attorney to go after polluters, I created one of the first environmental justice units in our nation. Donald Trump stood in Mar-a-Lago and told big oil lobbyists he would do their bidding for a $1 billion campaign contribution. At this example of Trump's massive corruption, booing erupted. During the foreclosure crisis, I took on the big Wall Street banks and won $20 billion for California families, holding those banks accountable for fraud. Donald Trump was just found guilty of 34 counts of fraud. Pivoting, I said that our campaign was about more than the stark contrast between my record and Trump's. The campaign, I stressed, was about two very different versions of our country going forward. One focused on the future, one mired in the past. Trump wanted to take us back to failed trickle-down economics that had never done a thing to lift the middle class and instead brought only more inequity. He romanticized a time when freedom and rights were limited and denied to so many Americans. I was born into a fight for freedom and stood in that tradition. Freedom to vote, to control one's own body, to breathe clean air and drink clean water, to be free from the fear of weapons of war on our city streets and in our children's classrooms. Freedom from anxiety about healthcare costs, childcare costs, a retirement spent in poverty. Freedom to afford a home, build wealth, provide our kids a good education. The freedom not just to get by, but to get ahead. And the freedom to simply be. Finally, I wrapped up with the kind of call and response familiar to me from the church of my childhood. Do we believe in the promise of America? The crowd affirmed it. And are we willing to fight for it? Yes, they cried. And when we fight, we win. July 23rd, 105 days to the election. The bleachers in the very warm gym of West Allis Central High School, just outside Milwaukee, were packed. Hundreds more supporters crammed the floor in front of the stage, fanning themselves for some relief from the heat. When the cheering finally died down enough to allow me to start speaking, I told the crowd, "The path to the White House goes through Wisconsin." I would campaign in the state 17 times before Election Day, the venues getting ever larger to accommodate swelling crowds. But this was the first rally of my campaign, my first chance to define the intersection of what Joe stood for and what I stood for, and how, as much as we were alike, we were also very different. With my staff in the prep room, I'd come up with a new line for the speech. Trump's slogan, "Make America Great Again," was very telling. Again, his agenda was to drag America backward. Not a goal of progress, but regression. I also wanted to remind the audience how cruel and chaotic his first term had been. "We're not going back." As soon as I delivered the line, the audience, unprompted, began chanting it back at me, emphatically. Backstage, Ike, Brian, and Sheila nodded. "That works." I'd been trying to draft the speech at home the night before, after Doug, Tony, and I returned from Delaware. It had been an emotional seesaw of a day, the poignancy of Joe's remarks, and then the enthusiastic reception that had followed. Mina had stayed on at the vice president's residence, wanting to be helpful. She also, I think, wanted the girls to experience this moment in history. But my baby nieces weren't all that interested in history. They were interested in making meatballs. I wasn't the candidate embarking on the fight for the future of their country. I was still just Auntie. While I huddled with Tony and Doug trying to work on the next day's priorities, the girls zoomed around the house, oblivious. "What's for dinner? What movie can you watch with us?" It was Doug who gently pointed out that at this moment, it was a level of multitasking even above my capacity. The girls, he said, would need to head back home. When I left for Milwaukee, they traveled with me in my motorcade. Two munchkins, flanked by burly Secret Service agents, to the landing zone for Marine 2. I blew a kiss and waved goodbye to them as the chopper rose over the rooftops of Washington, D.C. As I was delivering my speech in Milwaukee, Doug was in McLean, Virginia, for an event that had long been on his schedule, a roundtable with people affected by the Dobbs decision, held at a reproductive health clinic that had opened in response to the overturning of Roe v. Wade. It was serving not only Virginians, but also rising numbers forced to travel from states with abortion bans. Since Dobbs, Doug had made it a big part of his role to talk to men about why the crisis of reproductive freedom was an issue for all of us, not only women. He was determined to keep the clinic on his schedule to highlight what he termed the post-Dobbs hellscape. Doug was staffed by a tiny team, all that had been necessary for campaign events of a second spouse. At most of his previous events, there might have been one or two local reporters. Now, there were scores of national media. As he left the meeting, reporters shouted questions. One asked for his reaction to a remark about me that Trump had posted on Truth Social. "Lion Kamala Harris destroys everything she touches." "That's all he's got?" my Jersey boy shot back. "My Dougie. I kissed a lot of frogs before fate, and my best friend Chrisette delivered me the amazing Douglas Craig Emhoff, first second gentleman of the United States." Doug was born into a loving Jewish family in Brooklyn. His dad was a shoe designer, and they moved to New Jersey when Doug was about 5. He had most of his schooling there, and the guys from his kindergarten remain some of his best friends. They're still on a group chat that's active every day. When he was 16, the family relocated to California, and that's where he went to college and law school. Money was tight, so he worked full-time, parking cars, waiting tables, and slinging burgers at McDonald's so that he could afford to go to college part-time. Later in the campaign, when Trump put on a McDonald's apron serving fries as a stunt, it was particularly galling. Doug, my sister Maya, and I had all sweated over those McDonald's deep fryers in our teens. I vividly remember my annoyance when I learned that my cousin, who was bagging groceries that summer, made more than me. Meanwhile, Trump got handed $413 million from his daddy, and then his companies went bankrupt four times. Chrisette met Doug when he quickly resolved a lawsuit for her family that had dragged on for years. She was impressed by his smarts and his sense of humor. When she set us up on a blind date in 2013, she implored me, "Don't Google him." She was afraid I'd see some corporate headshot of a bland white guy and back out of the date. I was attorney general at the time. He was a successful law firm partner, specializing in entertainment law and intellectual property. One of his cases centered on who had created the character of the Taco Bell Chihuahua. He was divorced, parenting two young teens with his ex-wife, Kirsten. As a child of divorced parents, I was determined to take it slowly. I didn't want to come into Cole's and Ella's lives unless this was going to be serious. Doug, however, already knew it was. "I'm too old to play hide the ball," he emailed me after our first date. "I want to see if we can make this work." We were married less than a year later, with Maya officiating. So much for slowly. Doug hadn't been particularly into politics before we met. He was always a Democrat. He always voted. But like many people busy building a career and raising kids, he mainly tuned in around election time and wasn't deep in the weeds. I'd run virtually unopposed for my second term as AG, so the first year of our marriage was politically uneventful. We were able to take weekends away and do relatively normal date nights. Poor Doug didn't realize that politics is hard. When Barbara Boxer announced she wouldn't be running for senator in 2016, we sat out by the fire pit in the backyard with a big yellow legal pad and wrote out the pros and cons of running for her seat. If I ran, I thought I would be elected to serve just as Hillary Clinton would make history as the first woman president. It didn't go that way, and we arrived in Washington, D.C. to endure Trump's first era of chaos and cruelty. There was good work to be done pushing back against that agenda. I'm proud of holding feet to the fire in Senate hearings, asking tough questions that revealed the nature of Bill Barr, Jeff Sessions, and Brett Kavanaugh. I'm proud that we secured billions for community banks and that we raised federal relief for wildfires to the same level as other natural disasters. And I'm proud that as a member of the Senate Intelligence Committee, we investigated and then declassified our findings of Russia's interference in the 2016 presidential race. But the job was frustrating. As a former attorney general, I was used to being in charge. I'd make a decision and I'd get something done. Because Democrats were in the minority, the Trump-era Senate sometimes felt frustratingly performative. I yearned for a bipartisan era when senators could reach across the aisle to accomplish real improvements in people's lives. I was lucky to have Doug at my side. It's helpful to have a husband who wakes up with a smile on his face. He's also very protective. Once when I was giving a speech, a man leapt onto the stage trying to grab the mic. Doug barreled down the aisle from the very back of the hall and shoved the guy off stage. The fierce expression on his face went viral. Sometimes at home, I would see him staring into his laptop with a pained expression. And I'd know he'd found something malicious about me. I'd adopt a resonant voice, like a horror movie protagonist warning her partner not to go down in the basement. "Don't read the comments!" Doug soon learned that American politics isn't built for male spouses. In D.C., there are long-standing social structures and well-understood roles for wives, not for the very few husbands. While I was a senator, it didn't matter too much, since Doug still had the law firm work that he loved. But the day I got the call to be vice president, he made a huge sacrifice, gladly and without bitterness. He knew it was essential that there be no appearance of conflicts of interest in our new roles. So that was his last day at his law firm. But what was his new role? No one even knew what to call him. I came up with the title Second Gentleman off the cuff during a live interview on CNN. When I got back to the house, he said, "Okay, I guess we figured that one out." Now, in White House speak, SCOTUS, S-G-O-T-U-S, is an established, awkward acronym, just like POTUS and VPOTUS. Since as vice president, I was also president of the Senate, Doug became the president of the Senate spouses, upholding the traditions of luncheons and events originally designed for an all-female association. At the vice president's residence, we'd been given an organizational chart showing how the household was meant to function. Under the heading Second Lady, an arrow pointed to family life, which turned out to be a euphemism for housekeeper. While there were naval enlisted aides who helped with household tasks if I was in the residence, they vanished when I was traveling. Because it was a secure facility, we were precluded from hiring our own outside help. If Doug needed laundry done, he had to do it himself, or else hide his clothes in my laundry basket and hope they'd take pity. Since I'm the cook in the family, I needed to make big batches of food and freeze them for him so he'd have something decent to eat when I was gone. After warmly welcoming us into the Biden family at the beginning of the campaign, there seemed to be a change of temperature after the election. Understandably, after all the tragedy they had endured, Joe's first wife and daughter killed in a car crash, Beau's brain cancer, Hunter's addiction, the Biden family was extraordinarily tight-knit. I had always admired Jill for her fierce loyalty to her family and also her dedication to teaching. But I suspect Jill hadn't quite forgiven me for the 2019 primary debate when I'd gone hard at Joe over his early opposition to busing. Although I had regular working lunches with Joe, there wasn't a lot of family socializing. So 3 years in, when we suddenly received an 11th-hour invitation for the two of us to join the Biden family celebration at the White House on the 4th of July, 2024, it came as a surprise. We'd planned on being home in Los Angeles, where for the past 3 years, we'd used 4th of July as a chance to thank the Secret Service detail and the local police and first responders who looked after us whenever we were able to be home. Doug fired up the barbecue, and we'd personally cooked and served hot dogs for all 200 of them in our backyard. July 3rd is also Doug's father's birthday, a big family occasion. He was turning 87, and at that age, every birthday is precious to us. Because of the sudden request from the Bidens, we had to abruptly change the date for his celebration. The holiday came after a terrible couple of weeks for Joe. In his first sit-down television interview after the debate, he told George Stephanopoulos that he couldn't recall if he'd rewatched it or not. This was supposed to be the corrective interview that would fix perceptions. Instead, it reinforced them. Then there would be revelations that two radio interviewers had asked him pre-scripted questions provided by his campaign staff. It wasn't uncommon for staff to ask interviewers what subjects they would be touching upon. But in his post-debate context, it was damning. The chorus for him to step down would reach a crescendo, with Democratic members of Congress speaking out and celebrities such as George Clooney writing biting op-eds. The campaign had asked me to call members of Congress to assess support for him. That made me uneasy. I said I'd call only those I knew well, people who wouldn't misconstrue the call as some kind of self-serving fishing expedition. Amid all the chatter, gossip, and malevolence, I never let even those closest to me engage in the conversation about whether Joe should drop out. I know how this town works. Information is its most prized capital. What you know and what you're prepared to trade are the keys to power. Everyone is in this swap meet. Politicians, lobbyists, the press. Intentionally or not, word would spread that I was passively gauging their support for me, and I didn't want to hear anyone saying to me, you should run. There was no good way for me to respond to that. The last thing our ailing campaign needed was rumors of a rift between the president and me. What I didn't know then was that some of his senior staff didn't share that concern. In their own calls, trying to quell the rebellion, they'd been talking me down, saying, if Joe goes, you'll get her, strongly implying that I wasn't up to it. It was just one of the many ways his staff was responding badly to the crisis. They'd started cramming his schedule with more events, knowing full well that when he was tired, he did poorly. Hunter Biden's trial was underway, and I suppose the campaign wanted to distract from that and wanted Joe to be seen as functioning vigorously as president, despite the personal burden he was carrying. Instead, they were exhausting him. Whose idea was it to have him stand in the broiling sun at a Juneteenth celebration for 3 hours until, worn out, he was described as comatose? Many people want to spin up a narrative of some big conspiracy at the White House to hide Joe Biden's infirmity. Here's the truth as I lived it. Joe Biden was a smart guy with long experience and deep conviction, able to discharge the duties of president. On his worst day, he was more deeply knowledgeable, more capable of exercising judgment, and far more compassionate than Donald Trump on his best. But at 81, Joe got tired. That's when his age showed in physical and verbal stumbles. I don't think it's any surprise that the debate debacle happened right after 2 back-to-back trips to Europe and a flight to the West Coast for a Hollywood fundraiser. I don't believe it was incapacity. If I believed that, I would have said so. As loyal as I am to President Biden, I am more loyal to my country. What I do know is that he needed rest, and you're not going to get it during a presidential campaign. They don't call it running for office for nothing. Any campaign is a full sprint. A presidential race is sprinting through a marathon. Like a marathon, it is a test of endurance. Unlike a marathon, tomatoes are being thrown at you every step of the way. There was a distinction between his ability to campaign and his ability to govern. I was right beside him as he navigated successfully through intensely dangerous world events. Putin's threat to use tactical nuclear weapons on the Ukraine battlefront. The missile exchanges between Iran and Israel that might have escalated into a regional war if we hadn't rallied the diverse coalition that protected Israel during those attacks. His judgment, his experience, and the relationships he had developed were expertly deployed. As for campaigning, I did have concerns. His voice was no longer strong, his verbal stumbles more frequent. Apart from the superhuman stamina required, communicating is the main game. Before he stepped aside from the top of the ticket, I had planned to do many of the big public rallies and a lot of crazy travel while his team fashioned a White House-based campaign for him. Even so, his inner circle, the people who knew him best, should have realized that any campaign was a bridge too far and that in its rigors, he'd be perpetually, increasingly, unavoidably exhausted. They should have counseled him accordingly. Instead, it seemed that the worse things got, the more they pushed him. And the more they pushed, the faster and more visibly his energy seemed to drain. I had never, in 3.5 years at the White House, in the Oval Office or the Situation Room, witnessed anything remotely like the level of confusion, incoherence, and debility we saw on the debate stage. When Doug and I arrived at the White House on July 4th, I greeted Joe with our usual hug. He felt so frail. One of the staff drew Doug aside. The First Lady wanted to speak with him. He was led to the Blue Room, where Jill Biden was standing alone. She seemed tense, even angry. "What's going on?" she demanded. "Are you supporting us?" "Of course," Doug said. "Of course we're supporting you." "Okay, that's really important. We need to know that," she said. When I joined him, Doug was wearing a grim expression. Doug runs cool. He's slow to anger. But I could tell something had gotten to him. Later, he unloaded. "They hide you away for 4 years, give you impossible shit jobs, don't correct the record when those tasks are mischaracterized, never fight back when you're attacked, never praise your accomplishments, and now, finally, they want you out there on that balcony standing right beside them. Now, finally, they know you are an asset, and they need you to reassure the American people. And still, they have to ask if we're loyal?" July 24th, 104 days to the election. The first stop on the day's calendar had been planned months earlier, at a meeting in the Oval Office discussing her work uplifting Black executives and entrepreneurs. Dr. Stacey N.C. Grant had invited me to address the annual gathering, the Grand Boulet, of her sorority, Zeta Phi Beta. Now I was in Indianapolis, looking out over a convention center packed with 6,000 powerful women in dark blue dresses and white jackets. I'm a member of a different sorority, Alpha Kappa Alpha, the first Black women's Greek letter organization founded at Howard University in 1908. But these women are my sisters too. We're all part of the Divine Nine, the Greek organizations founded when segregation was the law in the South and standard practice in the North. W.E.B. Du Bois and Thurgood Marshall were early members of the first Black fraternity, Alpha Phi Alpha, founded at Cornell University in 1906. The Divine Nine has been an engine of uplift for generations of Black college men and women, instilling a love and celebration of excellence, philanthropy, and service to all mankind. My Divine Nine family would show up for me throughout the campaign. That day, I was so pleased to see the young president of Phi Beta Sigma, Chris V. Ray, and the esteemed president of Delta Sigma Theta, Elsie Cook Holmes. Throughout my career, I've maintained that people in positions of power must be required to ask of themselves, who am I not hearing from? Then make it their business to seek these folks out. I came to the White House knowing that the people in that building needed to hear from a wider range of voices. As vice president, I'd been given several roles by Joe Biden, but one role I created for myself was building up the diverse coalition that our party encompassed. I made it my business to get out there and make sure that no community was overlooked, especially those that had been taken for granted in the past. Black women, the Democrats' staunchest, most reliable voting bloc, was one such community. The Boulé in Indianapolis was one of a dozen Divine Nine gatherings I'd addressed since taking office. On this day, there was a new energy in the room as I walked onto the stage. A Black woman was slated to be the Democratic nominee for president. It was us. And everyone there understood what it meant, that this would be a journey of both joy and pain. I was in a room full of people with whom, because of our shared experience, certain words did not need to be said. There is an emotion that comes from being in a place where people see you, support you, know you. The kindness and the love in that room penetrated the armor I usually wore. Armor I'd need to put back on as soon as I left that room. The biggest applause came when I started to say what I would do to restore the rights of Roe v. Wade. When I am president, a roar erupted that drowned out the rest of that sentence. That roar told me they could see it. Clearly, for the first time, this could be, and it should be. It was not because of gender or because of race, but despite it. I thought, as I often did, of Shirley Chisholm, and I know they did too. The first black woman elected to the United States Congress and the first woman to run for our party's nomination. She had blazed the path, and now I was standing on it. From Indianapolis, we flew on to Houston to meet with emergency management staff and get a briefing on recovery efforts after the devastation of Hurricane Beryl. The Category 1 hurricane's eye wall had slammed Houston, bringing down power lines and leaving vulnerable people without air conditioning or water during triple-digit heat indexes. At least 20 souls had died. The economic damage in the billions was still being reckoned. These kinds of briefings are sadly familiar to me. As DA, I witnessed the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. As senator, I'd been to Puerto Rico after Hurricane Maria, and I toured the communities in my home state that had been ravaged by wildfires. It was heartbreaking to see the scale of these losses and the exhausted faces of individuals standing in the ruins of a lifetime's work, a lifetime's dreams. It was infuriating to see how predators swarmed like cockroaches, price gouging, spreading misinformation. But it was also inspiring to talk to the first responders who ran toward danger, sometimes helping strangers even as their own homes were at risk. And then there were the regular people who stepped up to help in whatever way they could, collecting toiletries, making sandwiches, organizing clothing drives. In my life, I've seen over and over that it is often the people with the least who give the most. As I shook hands and thanked the police and emergency workers one by one, in each, I saw a hero, the kind of person who answered a calling with a sense of duty to the well-being of people they've never met. A reporter in the press pool shouted a question about Biden's upcoming speech. It was just after 5 p.m. in Houston, and the president would be addressing the nation from the Oval Office later that evening. I watched it at the hotel that night. It was a good speech, drawing on the history of the presidency to locate his own place within it. But as my staff later pointed out, it was almost 9 minutes into the 11-minute address before he mentioned me. I want to thank our great Vice President Kamala Harris. She's experienced, she's tough, she's capable. She's been an incredible partner to me and leader for our country. And that was it. I am a loyal person. During all of those months of growing panic, should I have told Joe to consider not running? Perhaps. But the American people had chosen him before in the same matchup. Maybe he was right to believe that they would do so again. He was, by some measures, the most consistently underestimated man in Washington. He'd been right about his tactics for pushing his agenda through a resistant Congress. It was just possible he was right about this, too. And of all the people in the White House, I was the worst person to make the case he should drop out. I knew it would come off as incredibly self-serving if I advised him not to run. He would see it as naked ambition, perhaps as poisonous disloyalty, even if my only message was, don't let the other guy win. It's Joe and Jill's decision. We all said that, like a mantra, as if we'd all been hypnotized. Was it grace or was it recklessness? In retrospect, I think it was recklessness. The stakes were simply too high. This wasn't a choice that should have been left to an individual's ego, an individual's ambition. It should have been more than a personal decision. I was well aware of my delicate status. Lore has it that every outgoing chief of staff always tells the incoming president's chief of staff, rule number one, watch the VP. Because I'd gone after him over busing in the 2019 primary debate, I came into the White House with what we lawyers call a rebuttable presumption. I had to prove my loyalty time and time again. When Fox News attacked me on everything from my laugh to my tone of voice, to whom I dated in my 20s, or claimed I was a DEI hire, the White House rarely pushed back with my actual resume. 2 terms, elected DA, top cop in the second largest Department of Justice in the United States, senator representing 1 in 8 Americans. Lorraine, my chief of staff, constantly had to advocate for my role at events. She would say, she's not going to stand there like a potted plant. Give her 2 minutes of remarks. Have her introduce the president. They had a huge comms team. They had Karine Jean-Pierre briefing in the press room every day. But getting anything positive said about my work or any defense against untrue attacks was almost impossible. An example. In 2021, I was dispatched to the Elysee Palace to help reset our tattered relationship with France after we signed the Australia-UK-US Security Pact. Australia had agreed to buy submarines from France, but scrapped that contract when we and the UK agreed to supply Australia with nuclear subs under the new AUKUS agreement instead. This had caused tremendous friction. In our meeting, Emmanuel Macron and I warmed the chill by focusing on our many areas of cooperation, such as space exploration, climate change, transatlantic security, cybersecurity, the Sahel, and the Indo-Pacific. On that trip, I was invited to visit the renowned Pasteur Institute, where my mother had worked on mRNA research related to breast cancer. I was speaking informally with the scientists there about how I wished politicians more closely followed the scientific method, testing a hypothesis and adjusting according to results, rather than coming in with the plan as if they all had the answers up front. I said the plan with an exaggerated emphasis and air quotes. Fox News, The New York Post, and Newsmax went wild, claiming I'd faked a French accent. This was total nonsense, but the White House seemed glad to let reporting about my quote-unquote gaffe overwhelm the significant thaw in foreign relations I'd achieved. Worse, I often learned that the president's staff was adding fuel to negative narratives that sprung up around me. One narrative that took a stubborn hold was that I had a quote-unquote chaotic office and unusually high staff turnover during my first year. The plain fact is many people who come to work with a new administration in the White House haven't done it before. It's a job unlike any other. And not every person, no matter how talented in their former position, can step up into such a high-stress, round-the-clock role. Others find they don't want a job that doesn't pay particularly well, takes a massive toll on family, and rules out anything resembling a normal life. I'm not going to keep people on who can't thrive in their jobs. It's not fair to them, and it's not good for the country. So the first year in any White House sees staff churn. Working for the first woman vice president, my staff had the additional challenge of confronting gendered stereotypes, a constant battle that could prove exhausting. I was the first vice president to have a dedicated press pool tracking my every public move. Before me, vice presidents had what's called a supplemental pool, as the first lady does, covering important events. Because of this constant attention, things that had never been especially newsworthy about the vice president were suddenly reported and scrutinized. And when the stories were unfair or inaccurate, the president's inner circle seemed fine with it. Indeed, it seemed as if they decided I should be knocked down a little bit more. The vice president should take on irregular migration. From March 2021 My assignment was to attack the root causes of the misery that was driving people from their homes and villages in Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador. Because I'd prosecuted cartels and human traffickers from the Northern Triangle, I was up to speed on the region and its problems, and had ideas about the kinds of investments and other interventions that over time would reduce irregular migration, help to bring stability, and offer people a safer future in their own community. Most people don't want to leave home. They don't want to leave their grandmother, their church, their friends, their language. And when they do, it is usually for one of two reasons. They fear for their lives, or they can't make a living. Much of that region is rural, and farmers are increasingly hit by climate events such as floods and droughts. If you can no longer grow food where you are, and if there's no other livelihood, you will leave, because there's simply no choice. Corruption and gangs thrive when there are limited resources. When Republicans mischaracterized my role as quote-unquote border czar, no one in the White House comms team helped me to effectively push back and explain what I had really been tasked to do, nor to highlight any of the progress I had achieved. I won commitments of $5.2 billion in new investments by private companies for the region. I'd already seen almost a billion of that money deployed, thanks to enthusiastic partners such as MasterCard, Microsoft, and Nespresso. I held numerous bilateral meetings with leaders throughout the region, especially with President Alejandro Yamate in Guatemala and later his successor, President Bernardo Arevalo. I had multiple calls with Yamate, warning him that I expected free and fair elections, sending my national security advisor Phil Gordon to reinforce the message in person, and publicly supporting Arevalo once the election was called. I met with activist groups fighting corruption and for human rights in El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras. Cabinet members pitched in. Tom Vilsack at the Department of Agriculture accessed resources to train farmers in the latest methods to increase yields. I worked closely with Mexico's president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, and later his successor, President Claudia Sheinbaum, on our mutual border concerns. The investment I was bringing was a bargaining chip with regional governments to crack down on corrosive levels of corruption. These American companies, I told them, would not invest unless real steps were taken. The investments I encouraged have connected communities to the internet and brought people into the formal financial system, creating jobs and opportunity. In the locations where I was able to bring new enterprises and greater stability, data showed it was working. Our investments had created 70,000 new jobs, reached over 1 million people with training programs, and connected 2.5 million previously unbanked people with banking services and access to credit. These people were staying put. I wanted to get that good news out. But White House staff stalled. Not yet. We need more data. The story remained untold. Instead, I shouldered the blame for the porous border, an issue that had proved intractable for Democratic and Republican administrations alike. Even the breathtaking cruelty of Trump's family separation policy hadn't deterred the desperate. It was an issue that absolutely demanded bipartisan cooperation at an impossibly partisan, most uncooperative time. No one around the president advocated, "Give her something she can win with." Then the Dobbs decision came down. Here was a huge issue on which the president was not seeking to lead. Joe struggled to talk about reproductive rights in a way that met the gravity of the moment. He ceded that leadership to me. I initiated a national tour and rallied the outrage in red states and blue states alike. As well as big public events, I convened roundtables, starting out with the 10 or 12 state legislators whom I would connect with resources in the Justice Department or Health and Human Services. Soon, advocates started attending, then healthcare providers, then families affected by restrictive laws. There would be hundreds of people at these meetings, building a national coalition. all this work upended the narrative that we were doomed to a shellacking in the midterms. We defied historical precedent because of our efforts on this issue. Since 1934, the president's party has lost an average of 28 House seats and 4 Senate seats in midterm elections. We lost just 9 seats in the House and retained control of the Senate. Joe was already polling badly on the age issue, with roughly 75% of voters saying he was too old to be an effective president. Then he started taking on water for his perceived blank check to Benjamin Netanyahu in Gaza. When polls indicated that I was getting more popular, the people around him didn't like the contrast that was emerging. In Selma, Alabama, at the commemoration of Bloody Sunday, when civil rights marchers were attacked and beaten once they'd crossed the Edmund Pettus Bridge, I gave a strong speech on the humanitarian crisis in Gaza. Desperate people had been shot when they swarmed a food truck, and I spoke of families reduced to eating leaves or animal feed, women prematurely giving birth with little or no medical care, and children dying from malnutrition and dehydration. I reiterated my strong support for Israel's security and called on Hamas to release the hostages and accept the ceasefire agreement then on the table. I also called on Israel for greater access to aid. It was a speech that had been vetted and approved by the White House and the National Security Council. It went viral, and the West Wing was displeased. I was castigated for apparently delivering it too well. Their thinking was zero sum. If she's shining, he's dimmed. None of them grasped that if I did well, he did well. That given the concerns about his age, my visible success as his vice president was vital. It would serve as a testament to his judgment in choosing me and reassurance that if something happened, the country was in good hands. My success was important for him. His team didn't get it. July 25th, 103 days to the election. "Your entry has electrified this race," said Randy Weingarten, president of the American Federation of Teachers. Her union had been the first to endorse me in an announcement on July 22nd. We were waiting backstage at the Houston Convention Center, where I was to speak to more than 3,000 teachers gathered for their annual convention. We could hear the crowd chanting, call and response, Kamala Harris. I took the stage to a standing ovation. Again, I led with Joe. "So last night, our president addressed the nation, and he showed once again what true leadership looks like," I said. "And over his entire career, Joe has led with grace and strength and bold vision and deep compassion." In the meat of my speech, I hit our key policy differences with Republicans. We want to ban assault weapons. They want to ban books. I gave teachers the love they so deserve, these dedicated, underpaid professionals who change lives. I spoke of the teacher who changed mine, my first grade teacher, Mrs. Wilson, the remarkable woman who had stayed in my life and shown up for my law school graduation. Afterward, the motorcade drove to the airport through a downpour, water running across the highway in cataracts. It made me concerned for Houston, for the impact of the next barrel and the next hurricane after that, concerned for all the great American cities and communities under threat from the weather disasters made more frequent and more intense by climate change. Everyone who said we couldn't afford to make the necessary changes to achieve net zero carbon emissions didn't seem to grasp that we couldn't afford not to. What sort of American economy would we have in a future where even Wall Street itself could be drowned by rising water? I had been the deciding vote for the Inflation Reduction Act, which was the most consequential climate bill ever enacted into law. My senior policy advisor, Ike Irby, is a climate scientist. It's an issue about which I am passionate, and one on which the United States president needs to lead. Part of the challenge with this very short campaign was that we had to focus on needs that felt more immediate, like how to deal with the grocery bill or the cost of childcare. Talking about the benefits that would flow from our green energy investments was too distant. We had offered generous rebates to low and middle income families to help them install heat pumps and other energy efficient appliances that would lower emissions and utility bills. But people hadn't yet had a chance to feel those savings. It was hard to get people excited about the prospect of much lower utility bills in the future, that the battery technologies we'd invested in would be cheap enough for every home to make and store its own power from sunlight. People were focused on the cost of things today. I needed to emphasize that I had plans that would swiftly lower the cost of housing, that would stop price gouging. Climate policy was a much longer and more complicated conversation. It had to include explaining our plans for a just transition, one that wouldn't leave workers employed in the fossil fuel economy behind. I knew that 1 in 5 voters, and an even higher percentage of younger voters, identified as being very concerned about climate change. On my college tour, young people had spoken frankly to me of climate anxiety, their fear that my generation's failure to act was robbing them of a healthy planet, a healthy future. I knew I risked leaving those votes on the table by not talking more about this issue. In this short campaign, I just didn't have time. I had to triage issues so that key information could sink in. Sometimes, I felt like the triage nurse who makes the call in the pit. Each one of those souls is important, but with the limited resources you have, you must choose among them. It was frustrating that I had to leave out so much. But as the advertising industry has long known, people must hear the same message 3 times before it even starts to penetrate. After the exhilaration of being with the teachers, people I greatly admired, I was heading to a meeting with Netanyahu, about whom I was more ambivalent. What I am not ambivalent about is Israel's security. As a young girl, I carried around a little blue box for the Jewish National Fund, soliciting support to plant trees in Israel. I believe Israel was right to respond to the atrocities of October 7. But the ferocity of Netanyahu's response, the number of innocent Palestinian women and children killed, and his failure to prioritize the lives of the hostages had weakened Israel's moral position internationally and created angry dissent within Israel itself. People like me, who understand the importance of a Jewish homeland, who value Israel as a democracy and as an ally, sincerely believed that the scale of the response and the denial of food and medical supplies to civilians were doing Israel grave harm. I'd been on almost every phone call between the president and Netanyahu since October 7. Soon after the pogrom, I met with the distraught parents of American hostages. Many in Israel feared that Netanyahu's priority was his own political survival, not the desperate predicament of their captive children. I had low expectations for our bilateral meeting. It was important to demonstrate our continuing support for our longtime ally, especially after such an atrocious attack. It was also critical to show that we were continuing to press our plan for a ceasefire that would bring the hostages home to their families and spare innocent Palestinian civilians. But as I stepped off Air Force 2 at Joint Base Andrews, I was forced back into campaign mode. Trump, being Trump, had backed off on his willingness to stick to the September 10th debate he'd agreed to. He'd been rubbing his hands at the prospect of another round with Joe. Now that it was me, he suddenly wasn't so keen. I stood under the wing on the tarmac and told the assembled reporters, "You've been asking me about the debate, and I'll tell you I'm ready to debate Donald Trump. I have agreed to the previously agreed upon September 10th debate. He agreed to that previously. Now here he is backpedaling, I'm ready. And I think the voters deserve to see the split screen that exists in this race on a debate stage. With the Israeli Prime Minister due at my ceremonial office in the Eisenhower Executive Office Building, I walked to the waiting SUV without taking questions. I met Netanyahu in the vast, beautiful space containing Teddy Roosevelt's mahogany desk. The inside of the top drawer has been signed by every vice president since the 1940s. It is an eloquent testimony to national pride in the peaceful transfer of power through the years. Netanyahu's hooded gaze and disengaged demeanor made it clear to me that he was running out the clock. He denied Gazans were starving and blamed Hamas for looting food. I interrupted to reiterate the need for an immediate ceasefire and a day-after plan that gave Palestinians some kind of political horizon. Netanyahu wanted only a temporary ceasefire to get hostages back, but did not want to end the war. It was clear that nothing would be accomplished. We'd outlined the terms of negotiation for the ceasefire back in May and made frustratingly little progress with either Israel or Hamas. Netanyahu was bent on undermining Joe Biden, one of Israel's staunchest allies. I had pleaded with Joe, when he spoke publicly on this issue, to extend the same empathy he showed to the suffering of Ukrainians, to the suffering of innocent Gazan civilians. But he couldn't do it. While he could passionately state, "I am a Zionist," his remarks about innocent Palestinians came off as inadequate and forced. That loyalty meant nothing to Netanyahu. He wanted Trump in the seat opposite him. Not Joe, not me. Netanyahu wanted the guy who would acquiesce to his every extreme proposal for the future of Gaza's inhabitants and add his own plan for a land grab by his developer cronies. It was distressing to see how this issue was dividing Americans. 10,000 incidents of anti-Semitic harassment, vandalism, and more than 150 physical assaults. A 6-year-old Palestinian child stabbed to death, his mother wounded by their own landlord in Illinois, synagogues, temples, and Jewish community centers scrambling to protect themselves with new security measures, 3 Palestinian college students shot in Vermont, leaving one a paraplegic, posters of Israeli hostages defaced and torn down from walls in New York City, campus protests, some of which harassed and threatened Jewish students and created an atmosphere of tension and fear. These rising expressions of hate were chilling. Long before October 7, Doug had become a leading voice in our administration combating anti-Semitism, speaking at the United Nations and representing the United States at Holocaust commemorations in Poland and Germany. Doug was proud of his Jewish heritage and its history of social justice. He was proud that Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel had marched beside Dr. King. Doug worked to inspire and reinforce that pride in young Jews, taking the press with him to visit his old summer camp and talking to the kids there about celebrating their identity. He believed in the idea of tikkun olam, the obligation to repair the shattered world, small shard by small shard. We were the first family at the vice president's residence to have a mezuzah on the doorpost. The one we affixed came from a synagogue in Atlanta where Dr. King preached when it opened its doors to black worshipers after their church was burned by segregationists. For any enduring peace, we have to let go of extreme rhetoric on both sides. The war in Gaza is not a binary issue, but too often the conversation about it is. I wanted to acknowledge the complexity, nuance, and history of the region, but it seemed very few people had the appetite for that or the willingness to hold 2 tragic narratives in their mind at the same time. To grieve for human suffering, both Israeli and Palestinian. Loud voices on either side claimed there were no innocents on the other, a position I found inhuman. And I know Secretary of State Tony Blinken, who was tirelessly hauling himself from Jerusalem to Doha to D.C., sincerely wanted to end the suffering on all sides. right from the beginning of the campaign, protesters who thought we hadn't done enough for Gazans tried to disrupt my rallies. I was born amid dissent. Civil rights were won through protest. My parents took me to demonstrations when I was still in my stroller. The people at my rallies had every right to do what they were doing. I understood them. I understood why they were angry. Usually the crowd drowned them out, and I went on with the business of my speech. But at a rally in Detroit, as I was detailing Trump's threats to climate policy and the Affordable Care Act, a noisy group chanted, "Kamala, Kamala, you can't hide. We won't vote for genocide." The threat to withhold their vote got to me. It felt reckless. Either Trump or I would be elected. The issue was not binary, but the outcome of this election certainly was. You know what? If you want Donald Trump to win, then say that. Otherwise, I'm speaking. Why weren't they protesting at Trump rallies? I wondered. I wished they would understand that sitting out the election or voting for a third candidate would elect Trump and kill any effort for a just peace, any hope for a two-state solution. I wrapped up that unproductive meeting with Netanyahu in under an hour and walked out to address the press. I sincerely reaffirmed my commitment